You know, when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what they really have? The streaming service actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only about 6,000 of those are available in the good old US of A. That means you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows. Unless, of course, you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location, protecting your devices from unwanted snooping and allowing you to control where streaming services and other websites think you're located. There are over 100 different locations to choose from, which means you have access to thousands of new shows and movies no matter where you live. This doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, a UK streamer called BBC iPlayer, and more. I was on a work trip in the UK during the final season of Game of Thrones, and I tried logging into my HBO account to watch a new episode, but the technology wouldn't let me because of geo-blocking. And I wish I had this app at that moment, because I now realize how incredibly easy it is to work around that problem. Here's a more recent example. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is not streaming on Netflix in the US, but I just fired up the episode where Dennis tries to have a peaceful mental health day, and technology keeps interrupting his plans. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, connect to a UK server, refresh Netflix, and the show just popped up. It's super easy. I've also heard good things about that show called Billions, but I've never been a Showtime subscriber, so I've never seen it. But it's actually available right now on Netflix in South Korea, and with ExpressVPN, it took 5 seconds to switch over and start checking it out. With ExpressVPN, you get high-quality streaming from devices like your phone, laptop, tablet, and TV, and crucially, it protects your privacy and security to keep your information safe from hackers. Stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you all 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film to get 3 extra months completely free. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for March 16th, 2018. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm the senior writer at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined today by Slash Film Weekend editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Slash Film writer Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
So we are going to forget the original introduction. Apparently, the people have spoken, and people don't care about us telling you what we're going to talk about. So let's just go ahead and start talking about things, guys. Let's kick it off with the trailer for Avengers Infinity War. The most recent trailer debuted earlier this morning. Chris, let's go to you. What did you think about this one?
It's all right. I feel like I'm Ebenezer Scrooge, and this trailer is Christmas, and I just don't really get it. I mean, I like these movies. I have no problem with these movies, but this trailer, I don't know. I saw everyone like freaking out about it on Twitter, and I just watched it with, you know, like, that looks fine. I mean, nothing looks real to me in this movie. Everything looks CGI and you know, really brightly lit. It just doesn't look, you know, that exciting to me. But, you know, I'll be there opening day. I will gladly see it. But I'm the outlier here in that I'm not as blown away by this as seemingly everyone else.
Okay, so Brad, are you as blown away as everyone else?
I wouldn't say that I'm blown away, but I'm definitely just as excited as I was before this. I mean, you know, the excitement's already really high for this movie, and it does have a lot to live up to, but I don't know. There's a lot of cool moments here. I don't think the trailer's necessarily cut in a way that makes it all that exciting or engaging, but there are cool moments to be seen here, and I think it's just the more about the prospect of this movie, I think, that is the most exciting, because we're getting the Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy together for the first time. We're seeing the culmination of all of the Infinity Stone stuff finally come together. This is supposed to be the Avengers' biggest threat. And so I think it really, it's more about like the idea of what this movie represents than what is shown here in the trailer. You know, I feel like they're holding back a lot of the best stuff because they know that this is going to be huge. But we get tastes of the cool stuff, you know, like with, I like the interaction between Star-Lord and Tony Stark, and I kind of like Spider-Man's reaction between them, just looking back and forth, you know?
Yeah.
And that, of course, there's great action beats, too, so.
Yeah, I also was sort of like, oh, yeah, this is fine. I was not one of those aforementioned people who were freaking out on Twitter or anything about it, but, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm as I've always been, I continue to be worried about the prospect of so many characters being in one movie together, and the idea that the audience has built up familiarity with these people and relationships with these people over many years, and now all of them are being crammed into one movie, it just, I can't get past the fact that each character is only going to have X number of minutes of screen time if everybody gets an equal amount, you know, which is probably unlikely. So I don't know. I'm hoping that they're going to be able to find some compelling way to make this whole thing work. But I think I can't trust a trailer in this one. I think we just have to see the movie to see how the whole thing comes together. But speaking about the trailer, Brad, I know you dove really deep into this thing and did one of our patented trailer breakdowns on the site. Was there anything that you noticed that may have escaped the attention of people on first watch?
Yeah, so there's definitely some cool details to notice here. One of the quick shots that I thought was interesting happens in Wakanda, and it's a quick shot of Shuri, who is Black Panther's sister. As we know, Captain America brings Vision to Wakanda in order to help, so they can help protect him from Thanos, because Vision was brought to life with the power of the Mind Stone, the Yellow Infinity Stone, and it's residing on his head, and it's very likely that he would not survive without it if Thanos were to pluck it from his head. And there's a quick shot of Shuri holding up a hologram of Vision's head as he lays on one of their medical bays, and it seems like Shuri might be tasked with trying to figure out how to remove the Infinity Stone from Vision without killing him. So that'll be interesting to see if they, she can actually pull that off. That seems like some pretty high-level stuff, and that's we're pretty well aware that she has the capabilities of doing something that impressive. Along with that, there's also an interesting shot that shows what appears to be the Guardians of the Galaxy going back to Nowhere. If you don't remember, Nowhere is where the Collector's Collection resides. It's in that that location that looks like a giant skull that has been... where the brain matter is being removed from it and used and sold for various things. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's a dark shot, but they're walking off of their new ship that they have, but you can see one of those little industrial vehicles that Rocket Raccoon flew around in the original Guardians of the Galaxy. And my best guess as to what they're doing there is, you might remember that even though the Guardians brought the purple power stone to the Collector, before that, the Warriors 3 brought the Aether, which is the Reality Stone, the Red Infinity Stone, for safekeeping in the Collector's Collection. So it's very likely that they are gone to see if they can track it down there, and maybe it's still there somewhere amongst the rubble after that explosion happened with the Power Stone on the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll have to see how that pans out. There's plenty of other cool details, too. Interesting. There's I think my favorite thing that I think it will be most intriguing is there appears to be a flashback sequence involving Thanos and a tiny Gamora. There's a quick shot of a tiny green hand grabbing Thanos's big purple hand,
mm-hmm.
and he's walking down this kind of like city street. It looks like Asgard, but I imagine that it's probably Gamora's homeworld, and this is where she's taken from her family because Thanos took her from her real father and turned her into his adoptive daughter and trained her to become this weapon.
Because
mm-hmm. It looks like there's destruction happening on that world too, so maybe he came and took over this, you know, place and then took Gamora away from her family. So that should be interesting to see a backstory about Gamora and likely Nebula too, as to how they grew up with Thanos, and it might give us an idea as to who Thanos is as a character.
Cool. One thing that is not in this trailer for Avengers Infinity War is Hawkeye. Chris, do you know why Hawkeye is MIA from this trailer?
Yes, yeah, so like you said, Hawkeye's not in the trailer. He's not on the poster either that was released today that features approximately 8,000 characters, but not him. Our own Peter Cerretta went to the Infinity War set, and he talked to the Russo brothers, the directors, and they provided a little insight about where Hawkeye is. Joe Russo said, coming out of Civil War, he's in the same position that Cap and Falcon are at the end of the movie. Coming into this movie, characters on Cap's side coming out of the Civil War, some made certain decisions and others made other decisions that led to different paths in them dealing with oversight in this movie in a different way. So Hawkeye's on his own journey in this movie, end quote. So he'll be in the film. He's just, they're keeping him out of the marketing for some specific reason, which I'm sure will become much more apparent when we all see the film.
Do you have any theories about where Hawkeye could be?
I don't know. Maybe he's, you know, he's at his farm chilling with his wife. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll find out sooner rather than later. I have a feeling even before the film comes out, something's going to leak, as tends to be the nature of spoilers like this. Someone's going to figure it out sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Brad, do you have any theories about Hawkeye?
I think he's looking for those chems that he never got from the Bourne Legacy.
Oh, man. Poor Jeremy Renner. Okay, so let's move on to the next topic of discussion, and that is Ava DuVernay is going to be directing a movie called The New Gods for DC Films. So Ava, who most recently directed A Wrinkle in Time, she actually flirted with Marvel for a little bit about the potential of directing Black Panther before ultimately deciding that she probably wouldn't have the creative control that she wanted on that movie. So she ended up passing on that project. And now she has sort of gone across the aisle, and she's going to be working with Warner Brothers and DC to direct an adaptation of The New Gods, which is based on a comic created by Jack Kirby. And in terms of what that is actually about, I asked our own Slash Film managing editor, Jacob Hall, about this, because I know he's like a big comics guy, and he gave me a pretty brief rundown, but I thought it was kind of funny, and I'll just read it to you guys now. He said, essentially, Jack Kirby came to DC after years at Marvel and was given free rein to do whatever he wanted. The result, an entire corner of the cosmic DC universe that he could build from the ground up. And that name is literal. These are the actual new gods of the universe, powerful beings with ambitions and hopes and schemes and takes that are downright Greek myth in their tone and presentation. It's no holds barred insanity from a master artist allowed to swing for the fences. That's why it's so hard to explain. There's no real hook here beyond Kirby went nuts and DC published it. Every character and nook and cranny is undiluted crazy sauce. So I thought that was a pretty good recap of what this movie is going to be about. It's, I mean, to put it in very simple terms, it's essentially, it has the potential to be DC's version of Guardians of the Galaxy. It's a very space cosmic-y kind of story. One of the characters that Kirby created for this comic was Darkseid, who is the, I guess it's the DC universe's equivalent of Thanos, basically this big bad alien creature that wreaks havoc throughout the universe. And even though Darkseid was teased briefly in Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, it appears that this story is not going to take place in the traditional DC films timeline that movies like Man of Steel and Wonder Woman and Justice League take place in. According to Deadline, Ava DuVernay is closing a deal with Warner Brothers and DC to direct this film. It's going to have a similar budget to A Wrinkle in Time, which is like around $100 million, maybe more. And currently, quote, there's no connection to the studio's other DC worlds. So to me, it sounds like this is probably going to be in, it's going to sit alongside the Joker origin movie as one of those projects that is under Warner Brothers yet to be announced production banner that they're like splitting DC movies into two kind of universes, where one is like the traditional trackable timeline and the other is more like one-offs that don't necessarily have to be involved and cross over with the other movies that exist in that world. So yeah, this sounds like it's going to be the latter, even though there is that Darkseid connection there that seems like maybe they would want to put that in the traditional continuity, but I don't know. What do you guys think about the idea of Ava DuVernay directing a movie that's essentially like a huge space cosmic epic like this for DC? Chris, what do you think?
I'm excited about it. I have not seen Wrinkle in Time yet, but I'm excited for pretty much anything she does as a director. And this just sounds like a really weird sort of project, so that alone just has my interest. I'm very curious to see what she does with it.
Yeah, Brad, what do you think?
I don't really know anything about New Gods, and sounds like an interesting premise. I think I'm more interested in the fact that Ava DuVernay wanted to go over to Warner Brothers and do a DC movie instead of playing in Marvel sandbox, but especially after making a Disney movie. But
I don't know.
You know, it's I'll reserve my judgment until we see something from it, since I'm not too familiar with it and don't really have any expectations.
Yeah, I thought you know, I wasn't crazy about A Wrinkle in Time, but I thought some of the coolest parts of that movie were like involved the spacey kind of hard sci-fi elements of it. So hopefully she's able to sort of translate those qualities over into this big budget piece of chaos that she's working on for DC. So, and it's also cool that DC is embracing female filmmakers. I mean, you've got Patty Jenkins, who's working on Wonder Woman 2, and now Ava DuVernay. So that's a big deal for them. Chris, what do we know about a reboot of Clarissa Explains It All? How's that for a transition between those two projects?
Yeah, so Clarissa Explains It All was a 90s sitcom on Nickelodeon. It was one of their first sitcoms, and the Nickelodeon is now planning a reboot where Melissa Joan Hart will return, and she, you know, obviously she's an adult now, and she'll have a child of her own. So it sort of sounds like what Netflix did with their Full House reboot, where, you know, the kids on that show were now grown up with kids of their own. So that's what pretty much all we know for now. They're just developing it currently for Nickelodeon.
So we know that Melissa Joan Hart is attached, that she like signed on for this in the event that it gets picked up, or is it just sort of like more nebulous than that at this point?
It's basically right now everyone's still in talks, but if it happens, she's likely going to return.
Okay. I watched a little bit of Clarissa Explains It All growing up. I know enough to remember, Brad, I think you were referring to this in our Slack channel earlier, that every time her neighbor, I think, or friend Sam would come over, he like slapped a ladder up against her second story window, and the same guitar riff would play over and over again every time that happened. And I remember that she had a really annoying younger brother. I think his name was Ferguson. And that's essentially the extent of my knowledge about Clarissa Explains It All. Brad, did you watch the show when you were growing up?
I did, actually. I've seen a lot of it, but much like I think Chris said in his article, I couldn't really tell you any of the stories from those episodes, like I could with, you know, like a Nicktoon like Doug or Rugrats. So I remember the basics of it. I remember the characters and, you know, like the dynamic there was between Clarissa and her parents and her brother Ferguson and whatnot. But yeah, I don't remember anything specific about it. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they can make this work as like a series that comes back. There's obviously plenty of nostalgic, 30 somethings who are probably interested in seeing what happened with this show from the 90s in today's, you know, society, I guess.
How many people, though, do you think among our age group or age bracket or demographic or whatever, do you think are actually going to tune in to a Nickelodeon show, though? I mean, like, I wonder how much of the, I'm sure the numbers exist out there somewhere, but for like Girl Meets World, for example, like how many of the people who watched Boy Meets World when it was on the air actually tuned in regularly to see Girl Meets World? Or is it just a name brand thing that maybe like the older, you know, like us, like the parents could offer this up as a suggestion to their kids or something, you know, like what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it'll probably be something where the adults maybe tune in for the first few episodes, maybe with their kids, and then like kind of let their kids go out and be like, all right, this is yours now.
Yeah.
Personally, I actually stuck around and watched Girl Meets World just because I was interested in seeing if the show would capture what the original Boy Meets World was, because for as goofy as you could say it was for being an ABC sitcom, it tackled a lot of storylines that most other sitcoms wouldn't. There was a lot of very genuine and authentic ideas that came into, especially because Corey's friend Sean, played by Ryder Strong, was a kid who was kind of from the wrong side of the tracks. He was around middle class, maybe even less so. You might consider him being a little bit poor, and they tackled a lot of those issues. And like, his dad essentially abandoned his family, and there was a lot of stuff about broken families and all these different issues that most shows that were on ABC or other networks at that time didn't tackle. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see if Real Meets World did that. It didn't as well, even tried, because of the Disney show, so it was like, ooh, cheesy too. I don't know, maybe Nickelodeon, for lack of a better word, has some guts to do something like that.
Nice. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm curious just from a morbid curiosity standpoint of this. I know it's not anything I'm going to regularly watch, but I'm interested to see if the younger crowd will give a crap about a Clarissa Explains It All reboot. But speaking of nostalgia, let's talk a little bit about Ready Player One. I know, Brad, you're really looking forward to this movie. Chris, are you looking forward to this? I know it's a Spielberg movie and you're a big Spielberg fan, but this one, I'm not sure where you fall on this one before you've actually seen it.
Let's just say if Steven Spielberg weren't directing this, I would probably never go see it. But because it's him, I have to see it. But okay. I'm a little nervous about it. So.
Okay, so yeah, one of the things that I was nervous about, I saw the movie right before the press junket, so I think it was earlier this week, and I don't know if I'm allowed to really talk too much about it, so I'll save those general thoughts. But one of the things that I'll say is I was very worried, because I read the book, and I was worried that a lot of the references, the pop culture references, would essentially sink the movie, that the movie would not be able to support the weight of all of these ridiculous random references that come through. But I think Spielberg does a pretty good job. I'm trying to come up with a way that's diplomatic about saying this, but there are definitely a ton of references in the movie, but they're not nearly as annoying as they could be. And they're not as annoying as, frankly, I found them to be in the book, because it's a lot different just seeing some little character fly by really quickly on the screen than reading the author, you know, sort of smugly describe things in excruciating detail in the pages of a book. So I think fans who are a little bit worried about that can largely put your worries to rest. But one of the, you know, we were talking about the movie has a bunch of references in it, but one of the references that was actually in an original version of the script that Spielberg ended up cutting out was to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So Zach Penn, who is one of the screenwriters, mentioned at the press conference that that he wouldn't let the writers put in the mothership from Close Encounters. And Spielberg said, "There comes a point where I would have had to just refer to somebody else who liked my movies and not make a movie about my movies. I let a couple of little iconic characters in from my films, especially the DeLorean, which came from the book directly. But otherwise, there were a lot of things that we could have put in but didn't." And Penn said, "Oh yeah, and if I could just say, because it'll never see the screen, I had this joke about parking the mothership and how difficult it would be. I don't blame Stevens for cutting it. I didn't know Steven was going to be directing the movie when I wrote it." So, I thought that was interesting that Spielberg is essentially cutting back on... He's trying to exercise some amount of restraint over the references that made it into the movie. But he also mentioned that there was one franchise that he could not secure the rights to, and it was Star Wars. And I thought that was a little weird. So somebody asked him how difficult it was for him to wrangle all the rights to all these different various pop culture properties. And he said, "Is Christy Mikosko up here? Christy spent 3 years with all of the Warner Brothers legal people getting the rights to all of these properties, and we couldn't get all of them. We couldn't get any Star Wars rights. Very hard. They wouldn't give up the Star Wars rights." And then Ben Mendelsohn chimed in and said, "You could have called me on that one, Steven," and everybody cracked up. So obviously he was in Rogue One, so theoretically he would have some sort of connection there. But the thing that I found interesting about this was that Spielberg could not get the rights to Star Wars, but he goes way back with Kathleen Kennedy, who is the overlord over at Lucasfilm, and Kennedy was like his assistant and ended up producing a ton of movies with him, going all the way back to E.T. So you would think that there would be enough of a friendly relationship there that she could like pull a few strings and get whatever he wanted to happen here. And especially, I think Spielberg was like on the short list to direct Episode 7 at one point. And yeah, this it just didn't happen. And also, I found it strange that like this is a Warner Brothers movie another Warner Brothers movie from a few years ago, The Lego Movie, actually managed to get, you know, that's another film that's full of tons of pop culture references, and that one managed to get the Millennium Falcon, Han Solo, C-3PO, Lando Calrissian, and Chewbacca all in that movie, but for some reason Spielberg's film was not deemed worthy enough to do that. I don't really know what's going on behind the scenes there, but I just thought that was fascinating. Brad, do you have any thoughts about this?
I feel like I'm when I see the movie, which because I haven't yet, I feel like I might end up being a little disappointed that Spielberg wasn't a little more generous about referencing his own movies. I understand his humility about not wanting to, because of the experience he had with referencing his own movies in 1941, and just because he's just that kind of guy. You know, he's not necessarily willing to show off his old stuff, just be like, hey, remember this guy? But yeah, I do find it surprising that he couldn't get Star Wars. I wonder if that was more of a studio thing than a not having access to the right people kind of thing. I wonder if maybe Disney was a little bit stingier about stuff appearing in this kind of environment, because having Lego versions of those characters appear in the Lego movie is a little bit different than having what would basically be photorealistic versions of certain ships, items, characters, what have you,
right,
in, you know, the world of the Oasis. So I can get that. I understand why that would be difficult, but that it is kind of disappointing that they couldn't get some of those references just for shits and giggles.
Yeah, and I think the Lego movie came out in 2014, and that was before The Force Awakens came out, so maybe that had something to do with it as well. The idea that these...
Actually, yeah. Well, you know what? Since the Lego movie would have been in development long before it came out in 2014, I bet you that maybe that was a done deal before Disney even bought Lucasfilm.
Oh, yeah, that's true, because that was in 2012, and a lot of these animated movies take, yeah, like 3 or 4 years or something sometimes to get up and running. So, yeah, that could be. All right, so let's move on to our next item, and that is a slasher movie is coming to Netflix, a brand new one. Chris, what do we know about this one?
So Sean Levy, who is the producer of Stranger Things, and James Wan, who directed The Conjuring and Insidious, and also Furious 7 and Aquaman, they're teaming up to adapt this a novel by Stephanie Perkins called There's Someone Inside Your House, which is described as a coming-of-age slasher film, which is a combination I don't think we've really ever seen before. So that instantly has my curiosity there. And it's about a girl who moves to a small town, and people in her town, her fellow classmates, start dying in very gruesome ways. So it sounds interesting. James Wan, even though he's involved, he's not directing it, but he's helping develop it with Sean Levy. So I'm curious about this. Hopefully it'll turn out well and not like Netflix's The Babysitter, which is another horror movie they made, and it was terrible. So we'll see.
Yeah, Netflix, I mean, I think we wrote earlier this this month that they're going to be releasing like 700 pieces of either movies or TV original content this year. So I don't know, the odds are sort of against them with that much, with the sheer amount of content that they're producing. But yeah, I'm hoping this one's good. It sort of reminds me in vague terms, the concept, the premise reminds me of that movie that Joseph Kahn directed, Detention, I think it was, which is also like a slasher movie set in a high school. Brad, did you see that movie?
I have not seen it.
Okay. What do you think about this one? Have either of you read the book by Stephanie Perkins, by the way?
I have not.
Nobody.
No, I haven't either, but I'll probably pick it up before I watch this whenever it comes out.
Okay. Yeah, Brad, what do you think about the idea of a coming-of-age slasher movie?
You know, it sounds kind of creepy. I mean, I guess you could say that maybe we got a little bit of a coming-of-age slasher film with Rob Zombie's Halloween, since he gave Michael Myers an origin story. But I don't know, like... When they say coming of age, because like for me, coming of age movies are charming and, you know, kind of delightful, and they remind you of growing up and like the trials and tribulations of that. And so like, are we supposed to identify with like a serial killer who is growing up and becoming a serial killer and feel sorry for him? You know, is it going to have the same elements of the coming of age movies that, you know, we like, things like Boyhood or... I don't know why I'm blanking on coming of age movies, because I like them so much. But like, you know, it just seems like a weird blend to me. I feel like it might have a hard time striking that doesn't make you feel weird.
Actually, isn't there a show or movie on Netflix that came out pretty recently about like a pair of teenagers who, oh God, I probably shouldn't have even brought this up because I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, you're right. It's, I mean, that's kind of the same thing. They're basically both kind of sociopaths, psychopaths, just teenagers with these dark tendencies. And one of them is on the verge of basically like becoming a murderer. It's the end of the fucking world.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay.
And so yeah, but like I don't know. That's kind of, I guess that if they're doing something like that, it could work because it's dark comedy. And it plays up some of those darker aspects for laughs, but I mean, I don't know, like I'm not saying it can't work, but it just sounds kind of weird to describe it like that.
Yeah, and Chris, you mentioned in your article that James Wan is not directing this, right?
Yes, that's correct. It doesn't say who is directing it, but he is not going to direct it.
And I mean, Shawn Levy is the guy who he's one of the producers of Stranger Things, and I think they sort of name check Stranger Things in one of the descriptions for this movie. Is that right?
Yeah, it's apparently has that same nostalgic 80s, and they also reference the 90s sort of slasher movie tone mixed with John Hughes is how they're describing it. So again, I mean, you know, that just sounds like the sort of thing like a producer says in a pitch meeting because it
Right.
sounds good. Like we'll see if it actually turns out that way.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's move on to our last item of today, and that is the Star Wars: The Last Jedi commentary. Brad, you listened to this and actually wrote up an in-depth article about everything we learned from that. I don't want to ask you to rehash that entire thing. I want to encourage people to go to the site and check it out. We've linked to the article and all these other articles that we've talked about in the show notes for this podcast episode. But can you tell us, I don't know, maybe your two or three favorite things that you learned from the Last Jedi commentary?
One thing that I thought was pretty cool was when they were shooting the shots of Kylo Ren's smashed helmet on the floor after he throws a hissy fit in the elevator on the Star Destroyer. Originally, the helmet that they when they were shooting it was just kind of split in two a little bit, and you could still see its full form. And once they had gotten some shots with it, Rian Johnson said, "You know what?" He's like, "I feel like we need to break it more." And I guess he just went and just smashed the helmet like himself, like just went and just started stomping on it and crushing it, and then that's when they shot and what they ended up using in the movie. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Nice.
For anyone who was kind of disappointed with how Kylo Ren kind of lost the helmet and, you know, basically reneged on what J.J. Abrams had set up for his character, the explanation behind as to why he made this change is pretty interesting. You can either read the article to find out about it or just listen to the whole commentary yourself. On top of that, Rian Johnson has two cameos in this movie. You don't ever see his face, but you do see his hand. His hand is actually the one that reaches up to grab Han Solo's golden dice off of from the Millennium Falcon cockpit. It's not Mark Hamill's hand, it is Rian Johnson's hand. And he also lent his voice to the snobby alien that we see on the floating yacht in one of the early shots on Canto Bight. It's an alien that kind of looks like he has a tentacle mustache, you know, kind of like a snobby sea captain.
Do you
So I thought
know
that.
if the reason that he put his hand in there holding up that dice was because Mark Hamill was unavailable to shoot that, or if that's just something that did he mention in the commentary if that was just like a cool way for him to get himself involved in the movie?
He didn't say necessarily why it was like that, whether it was he was motivated to do that, but it is an insert shot, so it's probably just one of those things where they didn't necessarily need Mark Hamill to do
Right.
it because it was just a gloved hand that was reaching up for the thing, so anybody really could have done it. And so Rian Johnson was probably like, "Well, I'll do it," and just, you know, because putting yourself in your own movie, especially a Star Wars movie, is pretty fun. And then one final cool thing is, I guess Rian Johnson brought in Frank Oz to help him in the editing room when he was piecing together the sequence with Luke Skywalker and Yoda. Frank Oz is a director himself. He's done a few pretty great movies, and Rian kind of wanted his input because when you're cutting scenes together with a puppet that was on set, apparently it can be kind of difficult to do it and make things seem natural. And so he wanted kind of Frank Oz's input in the while they were editing, so they could cut around the footage that they had and make it seem, you know, that Yoda never really seemed fake, and that it always seemed, you know, just as quote unquote real as he did from Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
That's very cool. Chris, have you had a chance to check out any of the special features on the Last Jedi yet?
Not yet. I'm going to do it soon because I'm going to have a review of the Blu-ray, and I'm excited to dig into them.
Awesome. All right. Well, you can find that at slashfilm.com, as well as all more information about all the stories that we talked about on today's show. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features that you can find on the website. You can subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, all of the popular podcast apps. Please send your feedback, questions, or concerns, or comments, or anything, really, to peter@slashfilm.com, and be sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we do mention your email on the air. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Spread the word, tell your friends. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys on Monday.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.